What we're going to do tonight. What I wanted to do is to spend this week and next week in the evening on the idea of leadership from a scriptural perspective. Part of the reason for that is that obviously we are in a church, as a church, are in a process of looking at leadership, of establishing a proper eldership here in the church. And in order to do that, we should understand a little bit about what leadership is from God's perspective. Beyond that, I'll share with you the fact that this has been a study of mine for the last few months. I came across a book by a gentleman named John Maxwell. He writes a lot of books, actually, on leadership from a biblical perspective. Sometimes I wonder about some of these guys because I feel like I'm reading the same book over and over again. If you read the first one, then you read the second one, it's just kind of a rehash in a different format of the other one. But I will tell you that I found his book very helpful, whichever one I guess you pick up. I found very helpful towards the idea of leadership because he takes such a biblical stance towards it. Not only does he take what I believe to be a correct biblical approach as far as what the interpretation and application of the word, but he also looks at leadership from the fact that God ordains leadership and that godly leadership has a certain characteristic to it. And so rather than read the world's perspective of leadership, which can come from just about anywhere, it's pretty amazing actually to look at a bookshelf in a business bookstore on leadership, because you'll see a book like Jesus CEO, which I don't know whether that's appropriate or not, but Jesus CEO right next to a book, Tony Soprano, The Leadership Style of Tony Soprano or something like that. And then right next to that is, you know, the CEO of GE or whoever it is writing a book, and that's right there with leadership too. And so I guess what I say that is that there's many, many perspectives on leadership. And there's, just like anything else in life, there's many wrong ones. There is one book that we go to for wisdom, and that book would be the scriptures that you have before you right now. So what we want to do this week and next week is look at it from that perspective. And the reason I bring up that one particular book is because I'll share with you the fact that I liberally took from that book on the idea of the comparison of David and Saul. It's not something that's original to me in that particular regard, but you might want to pick up the book at some time and read it if you're ever interested in that subject. You may find some benefit by it. But in the book of 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, we have the account of Saul and David's life. And in 1 Samuel chapter 9, we'll start looking at that just right now. And we'll look at how Saul kind of comes about being a leader. The first thing I want to take a look at tonight is that much like anything else, the scriptures seem to be opposed to the general knowledge or general common sense of the world. If you were to look at the two men that we're going to deal with, Saul on one hand and David on the other, you would normally say that Saul is the much better leader, that he is the greater leader of the two. We'll see in a few minutes here why those characteristics externally would lead people to say that. When I was in the, Air Force, I went through both the Army and the Air Force basic training. When I went through the Air Force basic training, one of the things I noted was they took the four tallest guys and they made them the squad leaders. You had four squads and they made the four guys, the tallest guys, the squad leaders. Then they took the tallest of the tall guys and they made him the flight chief. He was over 50 people. So in other words, the tallest people were made the squad leaders right off the bat. And I noticed that in pretty much every one of the flights that I noticed coming in there. The flight would be 50 people, basically. It's kind of where they group people together in basic training. And the other thing I noticed was that within a week or two, at least two of those guys were fired from their job as squad leaders and replaced by somebody short, somebody whatever, somebody that was not the tallest, obviously. It was not one of those group of four. The other thing you'll hear about salespeople in general in life, which is normally should be somewhat of a leader position that people would follow and buy from, is that they're tall guys with good hair. That's the thing you'll often hear about salespeople, tall guys with good hair. So the general view of the world towards leadership is that you have to have a certain look, have to have a certain size, have to have a certain presence in a crowd, if you will. And from all practical purposes, Saul should be that man and David should not. That's the one thing we'll see about this. Saul should be that man, and David should not. Yet what we see in the end is that David is the far greater leader than Saul is. Now, that's not always going to be true. I simply just point that out to the fact that, once again, the Scripture seems to go against the idea of the common sense of man And instead shows us where we're confounded by that. So let's read in 1 Samuel chapter 9 just to start picking up on the idea of who Saul was, and then we'll look at David. 1 Samuel chapter 9 says in verse 1, "Now there was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Becherath, the son of Ephiah, the son of a Benjamite, a mighty man of valor. He had a son whose name was Saul, a choice and handsome man, and there was not a more handsome person than he among the sons of Israel. From his shoulders and up, he was taller than any of the people." So that's our introduction to Saul. Our introduction is that he came from a famous background. His father was a mighty man of valor, and he has a long and proud lineage. If anybody were to say, does this man have a pedigree to be a leader? Certainly it was Saul. All of his genes, all of his family life, what he grew up in, the culture, the tradition should be being passed down, and Saul should be a great man, a mighty man of valor, a great leader. So the first thing we say about him is that he is that type. Secondly, we say that he was a handsome man. He was the most handsome man among the whole nation. If People magazine were being published in that day, Saul would be right on the cover as being one of the 50 most beautiful people in all of Israel, and he would be the top one. He'd be the one that would be the first one in the article or the centerfold or however it is they do that in that magazine. He would be it. He would be the guy that everybody looked to. Every woman would want to date him, and every man would want to be him, and that's who he would be. Finally, he was described here as being taller than any other man, by head and shoulders taller. Not just a little bit taller, but head and shoulders taller. So he's not even a fake Hollywood star like an Alan Ladd or a Tom Cruise that you come to find out one day that they're only 5'7" or 5'8", and when they were kissing the leading lady, they were standing on a box, something you never really realized until you saw the background, behind the scenes of the movie. But Saul was it. He was everything. Famous background, long and proud lineage, most handsome man among the whole nation, a big, tall man, rugged man, not described in any way, shape, or form in a negative sense from his external characteristics. So that's who Saul is, just from the standpoint of looking at him and picking him out and saying, is he a leader or not? You certainly would say that Saul was a leader. Now, David, let's turn over to 1 Samuel chapter 17. We're going to bounce around a little bit between these two books, but it's not a verse-by-verse study as much as it is. We're simply looking at these two men and picking up things about their life. So let's look at David just briefly. It says in 1 Samuel chapter 17 and verse 55, it says, "The king said, now when Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, 'Abner, whose son is this young man?' And Abner said, 'By your life, O king, I do not know.'" Nobody knew anything about him. Now, the odd thing of it is, if you read this whole passage, and I know you haven't, but perhaps you know this, the odd thing of it is he's a man who's already been known by Saul because he's been playing the harp up to this point. He's already should be known by Saul. Yet Saul looks at him and says, "I don't even know who that guy is. He's so insignificant in the kingdom. He's just this little boy in some respects. He's not tall. He's described as ruddy. He's not described as unattractive, but he's described as ruddy, a youth. Many, many times he's described as a youth. He seems insignificant. When we find out about who he is, he's simply called in verse 58, and Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of your servant, Jesse the Bethlehemite." No long lineage. No great, past valor in his family or heroes or anything like that. So what we have is a small, insignificant youth, one who's described as ruddy, one who's not described as strong or powerful. His background is fairly poor, small house. Nothing that would particularly stand out about him. Now, if people were to realize what his true lineage was, especially compared to Saul being of the tribe of Benjamin, obviously was not of the tribe of Judah, which meant that he was not in the lineage of Christ. But of this young man, he would be in the lineage of Christ because he was of the tribe of Judah, where the lion would come from, where the king would come from eventually. So anybody should have, studying really Scripture and understanding Scripture, should have looked at Saul and said, you know what, he really can't be the one, can he? But they didn't know that, of course. They didn't think about those things in that particular regard. We have kind of the benefit of 20/20 hindsight. So David, nothing special, just Jesse the Bethlehemite, where he comes from. He was handsome, but he was not the most handsome. In fact, he wasn't even the most handsome among the sons of Jesse. Because when Samuel came, he thought, surely it'd be this one. He's a good-looking one. No, it's not even him. It's that boy that's out back. He wasn't even the best-looking of the sons of Jesse. He was not tall. He was not powerful. But he was a man of God's choosing, and he was after God's own heart. That's the one thing we know about him. The only thing that distinguishes him from Saul in a positive sense is that he was of God's own choosing and that he was a man after God's own heart. The other thing we know about them, there are many things about them. Both men received counsel from God, but both dealt with it differently. If you think about it, both were anointed by Samuel. They both have a charge, if you will, given to them that is the same, so they have that same advantage. Both received counsel from Samuel at various times. They received knowledge and information and wisdom. They received counsel, but they dealt with it differently. They didn't respond to it in the same way, and we'll see that in a little bit also. There was a difference in how they understood leadership, and that's really one of the key issues of them. There was a difference in how they understood leadership. So when we start looking for leadership in a church or leadership in an organization, whatever it might be, but particularly in a church, we need to zero in on an idea of how does the person understand leadership? That should be a question we ask. It should be something we think about. How do they understand leadership to be? What does it mean? How would you define it? How would you go about establishing it in your life and in the life of the church? Of Saul, turn with me to 1 Samuel chapter 10. We'll see how he responds to leadership right off the bat, because it's going to tell us a lot about what type of a leader he's going to be. He never really gets... The thing you can find out about Saul is he never grows beyond simply the position of leadership. That's the one thing we know about Saul. He never changes from simply being in the position of a leader. And I'll elaborate on that in a little bit. But the thing we see in 1 Samuel chapter 10... Verses 20 through 22. Now, you should know that up till this point, the children of Israel are saying, we want a king, we want a king, we want a king. God keeps saying, you don't need a king, you don't need a king, you don't need a king. Finally, he says, all right, you want a king, I'll give you a king. Here's the man you're going to have. This is the one you want. And let's read about that account. It says, thus Samuel, he's bringing all the people together. In verse 19, it says, no, set a king over us. And so he said, now present yourselves therefore before the Lord by your tribes and by your clans. In other words, come as tribes and come as families and differentiate yourself in that way. Get yourself organized. Thus Samuel brought all the tribes, in verse 20, of Israel near, and the tribe of Benjamin was taken by lot. So they cast lots, basically, and they said, you know what, the tribe of Benjamin, this man's going to come from that. So we're going from 12 tribes to one, and the king will come from this particular tribe. Then he brought the tribe of Benjamin nearby its families, and the Matrite family was taken, and Saul the son of Kish was taken, but when they looked for him, he could not be found. So here's this great new leader of the children of Israel. Where is he to be found? Therefore they inquired further of the Lord, has the man come here yet? So the Lord, it's interesting, the Lord had to tell him this. So the Lord said, behold, he's hiding by himself in the baggage. And I don't mean to laugh too much, but that makes me laugh. I got to be honest, that makes me laugh. Because here's people who said, we want a king over us. And God says, I'll give you a king. Here's your king, O Israel. They turn around, where is he? He was just here, wasn't he? Where is he at? Has he come here yet? Was he here? Where was he at? And they can't find him. And God says to them, your king, he's over there hiding in the baggage. He's over there hiding from you. He doesn't really want to be a king. He doesn't have a desire of leadership is what it comes down to. He does not desire it. Now, this is a requirement of a New Testament elder. It's a man that has to desire the office. If any man desires the office, if they want that office in that regard, and we studied that some time ago, they have to have a desire, a burning desire, not only an external capability or an external ability and showing things externally, but they have to have an inward passion and desire to lead that. The one thing about leadership is it does not work unless the leader has a passion for what he's leading. It simply does not work. Because as soon as it gets difficult, he just goes and hides. That's what Saul does later on when Goliath comes out and says, send out your champion, and I'll fight him, and whoever wins then will determine this whole battle between the Philistines and the Israelites. Now, that champion should have been Saul. He was the king. He was the tallest. He was the biggest. He was the leader. But where was he? He's hiding away in the palace. He's not even on the battlefield at this point. He's hiding away, just like he did back here. So Saul never moved beyond the position of leadership. He never really embraced it in the way he should have been. He thought, this is an important point to note, he thought his position of leadership was all that was required. In other words, if he were to be given the position of leadership, then really the idea of leadership would flow from that. And that's not what happens, though. We've all had, most of us have had a boss we didn't really care to work for. And the only reason we worked for them was because they had the position of being boss. And if we don't follow their leadership, we don't get a check. Now, that doesn't work in the church, where everything's voluntary. Nobody's here because we receive a check. So leadership then has to be able to really lead people, not by position, because nobody cares about the position in a voluntary organization. We only care about the position in an organization where that position we are dependent upon for our very life. But in a church, it's a voluntary organization. I can go somewhere else if I don't like the leadership here. I don't care if they're in the position of leadership. I can go somewhere else. But Saul thought his position of leadership was all that was required. He thought that as king, he would be the de facto leader. But in fact, who did the people gravitate towards? They gravitated towards David. They followed David instead of Saul. They sang of David and his 10,000 rather than Saul and his 1,000. Saul never expanded or enhanced the nation. He didn't do anything for the nation. He didn't build it up. He did not build it into a power. He simply maintained what he was given, and only that with some help. You'll see the one good thing that Saul does fairly early on is he surrounds himself with men of valor. He's not a man of valor himself, but at least he can see it in other people. And he pulls in some of those men and says, any man of valor, any man of capability with the spear or the sword, you're going to be my army. You're going to be my leaders. You're going to be my Abner, my Joab, those types of people. But he didn't expand the kingdom. In other words, the kingdom was not a force to be reckoned with. They always had to deal with the Philistines. They always had to deal with the Amalekites. They always had to deal with the nations around them. They were never a force to be reckoned with, and they were never respected in the earth as long as Saul was king. He didn't build anything. He didn't make it bigger and better than what it was. He simply maintained it. So the things we see about Saul and how he understands leadership is number one, he doesn't desire it. He hides from it. Number two, he thought the position of leadership was all that was required, when in fact it has to be more than that. And number three, he never expanded or enhanced the nation. He didn't make it any better than what he got. He didn't build it into anything better than what he got. Now, David, what do we see about his view of leadership and how he understood it? Well, we know that he did not shirk from it or any other leadership opportunity. He fought Goliath, where Saul did not, and he always looked for opportunities of leadership. He always looked for the opportunity. He desired leadership. He wanted to be a leader. Saul did not. David did. What did David do for the kingdom? He chose a city, Jerusalem, and he built it into the capital of an empire the entire world respected. To this day, it still stands, in fact, in that particular state. And to this day, we still call it oftentimes the City of David, known as the City of David. He built an empire. He didn't just simply take what he was received or what was received and just simply hold on to it or maintain it or try to keep it up. He built it into something far greater and far bigger so that he was the force to be reckoned with throughout all the earth. And not just simply a force to be reckoned with in his own kingdom because of a position. And keep in mind, a lot of this he did before he was even on the throne. He did these things even before he was ever on the throne. He wasn't on the throne when he fought Goliath. And he wasn't on the throne, some of those things we just read about this morning. He wasn't on the throne when he went out with 400 men and chased, I believe it was the Amalekites, and slew them all. Because they had come into his camp and had stolen his wife. His wives, I guess it would have been two wives, and the other men had lost their wives, and they lost their cattle and their sheep and all their things. And so he was always seeking after leadership, both before and after he received the position of leadership. In other words, it didn't take a position. It didn't take his name, David, King of Israel, for him to be the leader of Israel. For Saul, though, he always had to kind of put that King of Israel with his name, or nobody would have listened to him. Nobody would have paid much attention to him. And finally, for David, he was not a positional leader. He was a personhood leader. He was on the other end of the spectrum. Now, I want to explain some things to you, and if you have notes or you want to take notes, this might be helpful to you just to understand. The one thing that John Maxwell does, and so once again I take this from him, he classifies leaders at five levels. And this was interesting to me to see because if you think about it, it's actually very true. He classifies leadership at five different levels. So these are the five leadership levels that you might look at a person and say, where do they fit in at? Where are they at on that spectrum of leadership? Now, they could be moving, by the way, between these. They could be moving up, and hopefully it's up and not down. But these are the five levels of leadership that a person can be in. The lowest level of leadership is positional leadership. It's the one we've already described about Saul. The only reason anybody follows is because you have a title, and they have to follow to be in the organization. In fact, the one way you can tell who a leader is in a crowd is the ones that people are following. If a leader turns around and nobody's behind, then he's not really a leader. He might have a position, he might have something after his name, but he's not really a leader. So Saul was a positional leader, and that's the lowest level of leadership. The only reason anybody follows is because they have a title and they have to be follow to be in the organization, to have a job, let's say. The second level of leadership that is given is permission. They all start with a P if that helps you. It's permission. You have a relationship. A leader has a relationship with people, And in having that relationship, they like the personality of the leader. They find them to be a likable person. They like to be around them. And so you have their permission in a matter to lead them. In other words, you may have a title, but you also have, in fact, a likable character. And you have a relationship with that person, or you have a relationship with the person you're leading. Therefore, you have their permission to lead them. They don't have to follow you, but they will because of your personality and because of the relationship that you have with them. So that is permission-based leadership. The third level of leadership is production. In the production level of leadership, they follow you for what you do for the organization. They follow you because you make the organization a better place. You know the right way to go effectively. You know the path to take. They think you're leading the team in the right direction, and they follow because they're part of the team. They're part of the organization. They say, you know what, if anybody's going to know who to do, what to do, that guy's going to know what to do. Let's go and do what he says to do. That's what they say. And so that would be production-based leadership. They follow because they're part of the team. The fourth level of leadership is people development, that it is a people-based leadership. And this is the one that most good leaders will get to, hopefully. In this particular leadership, the people who are following know that the leader has an interest in them personally. In other words, it's not just simply what they're doing for the organization. It's not just because they're a nice guy. And it's not just because they happen to have a position or title or something that confers to them and says they're in leadership. But they're actually helping the person that they're leading. In other words, the person's goal that they're leading is important to them. They've said, what can I do to help you reach your goals? And then that person then will say, you know what? You have my best interest in mind. You are helping me, therefore I will follow you. And in fact, this type of leader, a people development leader, people will follow them from organization to organization. Because in fact, they're now following the person, not just simply the organization. They're actually following a person who has their best interest in mind. And so it's that they say that if that person leaves and goes over here, I want to go where they go because they're always helping me reach my personal goals. They're always helping me get where I need to go. That is people development. That is the fourth level. And the fifth level, which is very, very rare, by the way, very difficult to get to, is a level called personhood. They respect you for what you are and have done. They respect you specifically for your personhood, really. And they respect you so much that it becomes larger than life, and it becomes very rare. So you think of a person like General MacArthur, or George Patton, military leaders that are great military leaders can come to mind. Great business leaders can come to mind in some respects. Certainly great church leaders can come to mind. You see Paul, who was able to write to people, and they yearned to see him, and they wanted to see him, and they prayed for him all the time, and they sent things to him, and they supported his ministry wherever he went. That is a personhood leadership, is what Paul had gotten to. It was the highest form of leadership that a person could get to. So if we look at the spectrum, then we have positional leadership, permission-based leadership, production, people development, and finally personhood, the highest form, where they really follow you simply for who you are, your integrity, your person. And if you were to look at Saul and David, we've already characterized Saul as being in positional leadership. He's the king, so you have to do what he says, basically. That's the only reason anybody would do what he says. And even then, people don't do what he says. Even David, a youth, comes to him and says, I'm going to go fight Goliath, and says, you can't fight Goliath, you're just a youth. And he says, no, I'm going to do it. And so Saul says, okay, go ahead and put my armor on. And he says, I'm not putting your armor on. It's not been tested yet. I haven't tried it yet. He wouldn't even do what Saul said to do at that point. He called him, O king. He called him a lord at certain times, as a little L lord. But he would not follow him in that way. But he did have a position, and David respected that position always, if you'll keep in mind also. In fact, he's one of the few in Israel that perhaps did, because he said one time, we even read an account this morning in Sunday school, where that he cut off the little piece of his robe, I believe it was, the end of his garment, and he felt bad about it because he had done it. But he said, I will not touch the Lord's anointed, the one who has the position. He says, I will not touch him in that way. So he respected him for that. But David had reached, in fact, a level of personhood. People would follow him wherever he went in that way. And we'll look at that a little bit more in a little bit. So Saul, as we can see, was always stuck at the first level. He thought people should follow him because he was a king. And if we were to look at this, just turn with me to 1 Samuel chapter 18. 1 Samuel chapter 18. Saul really thinks that people should simply talk about him and follow him because he's a king. And in 1 Samuel chapter 18, And let's pick up in verse 6, actually. 1 Samuel chapter 18, verse 6. It says, "It happened as they were coming, when David returned from killing the Philistines, that the women call came out of the cities of Israel, singing and dancing, to meet King Saul," notice that picture there, "with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. The women sang as they played and said, 'Saul has slain his thousands, and David his ten thousands.' Then Saul became angry, for the saying displeased him, and he said, 'They have ascribed to David ten thousands, but to me they have ascribed thousands. Now what more can they have but the kingdom?' Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on." So in other words, his problem was is that I'm the king, and they should be giving me all the due and all the praise and all the glory, and instead they're giving it to David. They're gravitating towards David at this point. They're following his leadership. What more will he get than the official kingdom, than the official kingship, the position that I hold, the only thing that I've got to hold on to? What more can they do but to give him that is what his view is. So Saul definitely views his leadership as being positional and nothing better, and he never does anything more than that. But of David, though, let's keep looking at this chapter. Verses 14 through 16 of this same chapter, let's drop down to this. It says, "David was prospering in all his ways, for the Lord was with him. When Saul saw that he was prospering greatly, he dreaded him. But all Israel and Judah loved David, and he went out and came in before them." Do you see how he had ascended to a completely different level than Saul was at already? And this is early on in the life of David. He was not the king at this point, keep in mind. So it does not take a position, in other words, to be a leader. So if we're looking here at the church in that regard, and looking at an organization such as this, and being in the position we're in, we should sit back and say, now, let's not look at who positionally has leadership. Let's look at really who has leadership capabilities, who has leadership qualifications like David does. Let's look at that from a biblical aspect. Let's not just simply say, who were leaders before, and let's make them leaders because they've already been doing it. They've positionally been there before. Instead, let's really look carefully at the idea of who carries the characteristics of David that really leads the people so that it could be said about them. But all of Grace Church in North Olmsted loved fill in the blank, and he went out and came in before them. That would be the better way to look for leaders than to just simply look at it from a positional aspect in that regard. So that's the first thing we can say about them, is that they had a very different view in how they understood leadership. The second thing we could say about them is that in common, they both faced great challenges, but they reacted very differently to them. They both faced great challenges, but they reacted differently. Both faced the challenge of Goliath to send out the greatest warrior for a one-on-one. But what was their reaction to it? Saul hid. David, on the other hand, accepted the challenge. Saul even offers David his armor. How convenient, since he wasn't even using it at the time. But that's so he said, you can use it because I'm not using it, obviously. But David says, no, I won't use it. I only have one thing I'm going to trust in, and that's going to be the Lord. And that's my reason for going out. Not because I think I can kill Goliath, but because of the fact that he is insulting the nation of God. He's insulting the people of God. He's insulting the God that we serve. And I will not allow that to happen. And furthermore, he will not allow that to happen. And that's the only thing I'm going to rely upon, and so I'm going to go out and do this. And so they reacted to this very differently. They both faced great challenges, but they both reacted very differently. They faced the challenges of people outside, people inside the kingdom, and they reacted very differently in each of these. So they both faced great challenges. Thirdly, they both sinned, but they reacted differently. And this is important because leadership will fail from time to time. There's no doubt about that. There is no perfect leadership. David is a great example of that. We might be looking at him now and saying, wow, he's a great leader. He's the perfect leader. Well, no, of course, we know things about his life, even as we looked at a few of them this morning, that do not, in fact, show that. So they both sinned, but reacted differently. Of Saul, let's look at a couple of these. 1 Samuel chapter 13. 1 Samuel chapter 13, and let's read verses 5 through 15. It's kind of a long passage, but it'll be helpful to us. 1 Samuel chapter 13, beginning in verse 5. Now the Philistines assembled to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen, and people like the sand which is on the seashore in abundance. And they came up and camped in Michmash, the east of Beth-Aven. When the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were hard-pressed, then the people hid themselves in caves and thickets and cliffs and cellars and in pits. Also some of the Hebrews crossed the Jordan into the land of Gad and Gilead. But as for Saul, he was still in Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling. Now see, that's not a good sign for a leader. That's not confidence. There's no inspiring confidence of Saul here at this point for the people. In fact, you'll see they're also starting to scatter at this point. They're not following him. They're instead trembling. Verse 8, now he waited 7 days according to the appointed time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal. And the people were scattering from him. So they're further scattering now, even worse than it was described up to this point. So Saul said, "Bring to me the burnt offering and the peace offerings." And he offered the burnt offering. And as soon as he finished offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came. How convenient. And Saul went out to meet him and to greet him. And Samuel said, "What have you done?" And Saul said, "Because I saw that the people were scattering from me, and you did not come within the appointed days, and that the Philistines were assembling at Mishmash, therefore I said, 'Now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal.' And I have not asked the favor of the Lord. So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering." Samuel said to Saul, "You have acted foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as a ruler over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you." Then Samuel arose and went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin, and Saul numbered the people who were present with him, about 600 men. Not very many, according to all the people they were going to go out and fight. But here's the point to be made about this, is that Saul offers a sacrifice wrongly and is rebuked, but he seems to have no sense of the wickedness he's done. He seems to just not simply realize or care about what he's done at this particular point. Know that the people here were scattering from him when they most need leadership. They're all running and hiding. They're all trembling. When they most need leadership, they couldn't find it in Saul. Even when he's right there present with him, it's not like he's not physically there. But they're still not looking to him for leadership. And notice, too, how he uses, this is unfortunate because religion is used this way, he uses religion, quote unquote, to try and bring them back together rather than true leadership. So you notice what why he did that. He said he saw them scattering. He said, "You know what, we need to have an offering real quick here. That'll bring the people back together." So he was being pragmatic about leadership. He was saying that if I were to do this, it will surely bring the people and rally them around the altar, so to speak, rather than rallying around the purpose for which we're here and the leader by which that is leading them in that purpose. So it was unfortunate. Saul, he sins, but he reacts very badly towards it. He doesn't really care, it seems like. He just goes on with the battle, effectively. He doesn't do anything about it. He's not repentant. Turn with me over to 1 Samuel chapter 15 for the second example of Saul's transgressions and his reaction to this also. Now, in this case, Saul was told by Samuel that he is to go out and to completely punish Amalek. In verse 2 of chapter 15 says, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he set himself up against him on the way while he was coming from Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek and utterly destroy all that he has, and do not spare him, but put to death both men and women, child and infant, oxen, sheep, camel, and oxen." So Saul goes out to do this. He's told to completely destroy them. Now what he does is when he goes, he comes back, and the people either don't listen to him or he doesn't care, whatever the case might be, blames it on the people, we know that, but they bring back some of the oxen, the best of the oxen. They also bring back the king of the country, I believe it was Agag. And they bring him back, and so Samuel comes down and notices this. And let's pick it up then in verse 13. "Samuel came to Saul, and Saul said to him, 'Blessed are you of the Lord. I have carried out the command of the Lord.' But Samuel said, 'What then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear?' And Saul said, 'They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and oxen to sacrifice the Lord your God, but the rest we have utterly destroyed.' Then Samuel said to Saul, 'Wait, and let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night.' And he said to him, 'Speak.' And Samuel said, 'Is not true that you were the little one in your own eyes, and you were made,'" once again this position, "'the head of the tribes of Israel, and the Lord anointed you king over Israel? And the Lord sent you on a mission and said, Go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are exterminated. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord, but rushed upon the spoil and did what was evil in the sight of the Lord?' Then Saul said to Samuel, 'I did obey the voice of the Lord and went on the mission which the Lord sent me, and have brought back,'" he even knows right now this can't be right, "'and brought back Agag, the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people,'" notice how he blames it, that's not good leadership, by the way. That's not taking responsibility. "'The people took some of the spoil, sheep and oxen, the choicest of the things devoted to destruction, to sacrifice the Lord your God at Gilgal.' Samuel said, 'As the Lord has much a delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord, behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams.'" By the way, that little passage there, "As the Lord has much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord." Remember that, because we're going to see that in a few minutes. "For rebellion is as the sin of divination, and insubordination as the iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he also has rejected you from being king. Then Saul said to Samuel, he seems to be a little more serious about this time. Then Saul said to Samuel, I have sinned. I have indeed transgressed the command of the Lord in your words, because I feared the people and listened to their voice. That's important too. I feared the command of the Lord and your words. Because I feared the people and listened to their voice. Now therefore, please pardon my... See, he wasn't leading them. He was just following them at this point, is what he's saying. Now therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me that I may worship the Lord. But Samuel said to Saul, I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. And as Samuel turned to go, Saul seized the edge of his robe, and it tore. So Samuel said to him, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to your neighbor who is better than you. Also, the glory of Israel will not lie or change his mind, for he is not a man that he should change his mind. Then he said, and this is Saul speaking, I have sinned, but please honor me now before the elders of my people and before Israel, and go back with me that I may worship the Lord your God. So Samuel went back following Saul, and Saul worshiped the Lord. Now what we see there is first of all, Saul is not a leader. He follows the people rather than the people following him. What Saul is a people pleaser. He's not a people leader, he's a people pleaser. So one of the characteristics you cannot have in leadership is a person who is bent towards the idea of being a pleaser of people. They must be a leader of people, which hopefully will result in the pleasing of people, but it's hard. And oftentimes people don't want to do what they're being led to do that is the right and proper thing. And in this case right here, they wanted to do something, and Saul let them do it apparently, and it was to his dismay that he did it. The other way that you know he's a people pleaser is his reaction to this. His real concern was shown in verse 30 when he says, I have sinned, but please honor me now before the elders of my people before Israel and go back with me that I may worship the Lord your God. His concern is how am I going to be viewed after all this? Here I've been, I don't know how public it was, but I've certainly been rebuked by Samuel. But I don't want to have to walk back by myself, is what it comes down to. I don't want to walk back without looking as if, at least looking as if, I'm in communion with Samuel. I'm one with Samuel, who I know the people really do follow, by the way, and I don't want to be seen as separate from him. And so that's his real concern here. He wants to be a people pleaser. He's concerned about what people think about him, is what it comes down to. So when the people say, we want to bring back these sheep and these oxen, he says, sure, I want you to like me. And when he sins and he's rebuked for it, he says, don't let me walk back by myself. I don't want the people to see that. I want to be a people pleaser, and I want the people to like me, is what it comes down to. And so he has a wrong view. He sins, but he reacts very poorly in this. Now David, when he sins, and Nathan confronts him, it's a very different story. Now we won't go and read all of that, but I'll ask you to turn to Psalms chapter 51. We won't go read that whole account of David and Nathan, because Nathan, of course, we know David sinned with Bathsheba, and Nathan comes and gives him this parable, if you will, of a man who has many sheep, I believe it was, and he has a friend that comes, and he goes and he takes the sheep of the neighbor instead of his own. And David said that man should be put to death, and Nathan says, you are the man. And David's reaction to that, of course, is to be absolutely distraught. He's not concerned about what people think of him. He is only concerned about his relationship with God and how it's been damaged and how he's let it become into such a sad state of affairs. But he says in Psalms chapter 51, he says a couple of things that's important. He says in verse 4, and this is his psalm really of prayer before God in this event. He says in verse 4, against you and you only have I sinned and done what's evil in your sight. Now Saul, if you remember, said, I've sinned against the Lord and I've sinned against you. And that was never the issue, though. David knew that the sin was against the Lord. Saul's thought was that the sin was against the Lord and against this man that he wanted to please once again. Our only reason to please, or only one to please, is God. And David knew that, and Saul did not. And then if we look later in the chapter, and let me find it if I can. In verse 16, he says, for you do not delight in sacrifice, otherwise I would give it. You are not pleased with burnt offering. Remember what Samuel's statement was to Saul is that the Lord is not delighted in that. David knew this about the Lord. He knew the one that he was following. By the way, we might look at that next week. The idea of leadership is really supposed to be a good follower, is what it comes down to. But David knew that, and so he was able to distinguish that where Saul was not. So they both sinned, but they both reacted very differently in that particular regard. Now, we have several different things we can go through, but I'm actually going to cut that off at this point. We'll pick up next week. So let me just kind of review briefly what we discussed tonight, and I hope it was helpful to you. It's been helpful to me, but I hope it was helpful to you. What we saw tonight was that if you were to look at Saul and David, you'd certainly say Saul is the leader and David here, he's a shepherd. In fact, one of the things we'll take a look at next week, if you think about it, when this great man Samuel is to come to the house of Jesse, even his own father doesn't bring David into the house. That's how much he thinks of David. His own father says, you stay out there in the field with the sheep, and you take care of them. This great man's coming, but you're going to go ahead and stay out there in the field with the sheep. But all your brothers, they're going to be in the house here to meet Samuel. So nobody, even his own father, didn't look at David and say, this man is leadership in the making. Nobody said that. But of Saul, everybody kind of thought that because of his height, his looks, all those things. His lineage should have all made that. But that wasn't the case. Both men received counsel from God, but they dealt with it very differently. Both men had the anointing of Samuel, but dealt with it very differently. There was a difference in how they understood leadership. Saul saw it as being positional. I have a title, therefore I am the leader. David did not. He did not see it as such as that case. He was on the opposite extreme. Remember, there was positional leadership that Saul was at, and then there was permission, production, people, and then finally personhood. And David had reached the final level, personhood, such that all of Israel loved him. All of Judah, all of Israel loved David, where they did not love Saul. They'd sing songs about David, such as that. Of Saul, it was kind of a slap in the face, even though he was the king. They both faced great challenges. They both faced the challenge of Goliath in particular, and they both reacted very differently to that. Saul once again hid, as was his pattern. David said, no, I'm going to go out and I'm going to fight. And he didn't even take an armor or anything like that. They both sinned. The last thing we just looked at, they both sinned, but they reacted very differently. Well, next week I want to look at what are the limits on each man, because each of them did have limits. Everybody's got limits. I mean, every leader's got certain limits. The issue is, how does that person overcome those limits? And David overcomes his limits, and Saul does not overcome his limits. We will look also at how David was able to do something Saul could not do. He was able to grow and increase in his own abilities. And the other important thing for a leader is able to increase the abilities of those around him. You're not a leader if you're not increasing the abilities of the people around him. We call it today sometimes succession planning. If you die, what happens to the organization? Because if the organization dies, you really weren't a leader. You really weren't a leader in the organization. You had to develop leadership instead. And then we'll go through some application to us, because there's some important application for us to think about. Well, let's close with that tonight. I thought I had a song I wanted to sing, but I can't think right off the top of my head where it's at. But the song I want to sing is More Like the Master, so if somebody could help me find that, because apparently it's not titled that.